No, you can't. The sledgehammer wavers, as though caught in an irresistible magnetic field, and itches to dart forward. And then Andrew drops that end of the weapon to the floor. Leonard jolts in his chair at the thud of metal and wood. Andrew says, "I already killed one of them." And he motions at Adrian's body. Then he looks over his shoulder at Wen on the couch. Tears glisten in his glassy eyes, and he lifts the weapon again. "So I'm gonna kill him, too." "You're not a killer. Adrian attacked you with a knife, and you defended yourself. He's tied up and helpless. He's not fucking helpless. This is different. You can't. Wen is dead because of him. Eric, he fucking squeezed my hand, and when he did... Leonard sobs and says he didn't mean to, even though he promised nothing would happen to her. More flies leave Adrian's body and orbit around Leonard like they are pets called to their owner. Andrew says, "He made me shoot. The bullet came from the gun in my hand, my finger on the trigger. I shot her. It's not your fault." Eric pushes the weapon down. Andrew doesn't resist and lets Eric guide the weapon until the rake claw end is on the floor. He says, "It is my fault. I'm so sorry." "No, it isn't." Eric hugs Andrew. "It's not your fault. I will never allow you to say it is." Andrew doesn't drop the weapon to return the embrace, but he leans into Eric and rests his head on his shoulder. "Eric, what the fuck are we gonna do?" "We're going to leave, like you said." Eric holds on for another moment and listens to Andrew breathe in and out. He releases Andrew and steps back, noticing they are standing in Adrian's blood. He says, "Take the weapon, in case Sabrina is out there waiting for us. I'll get Wen." For an irrational moment, Eric fears their feet will be forever stuck to the floor. The blood is amber. They'll be fossilized, frozen in time, and not be found for millions of years. Eric lurches to the couch, not so much dizzy as lacking any sense of equilibrium. Every step must be thought about and planned, or the whole cabin will tilt like an unbalanced seesaw. Each correction he makes teeters into an uncoordinated overcorrection that threatens to topple him. He anchors himself by standing with the tops of both feet under the couch's low frame. Now that he's not concentrating on walking, he closes his eyes and prays, hoping God can parse the loose and stretched-out thoughts in his head. He asks for the strength to be able to carry his daughter away from this place. "Away from this place, away from this place, away from this place," becomes an interior mantra, and with its harried, manic repetition, the syllables and beats transform into unrecognizable noises not of language. Eric opens his eyes, and the sheet covering Wen's body is blackened with flies. They hover, and they crawl over and weave between one another. Eric cries out and waves his arms frantically over her body. The flies ignore him. They are fat and drunk. They are greedy. They are cruel and fearless. They are the darkening knots and threads of her shroud. Andrew says, "Eric, Eric, what are you doing?" "I'm getting them off her. I want them off her." "Getting what off her?" "The flies. They're all over our baby." The engine-like roar of their collective wings is deep and guttural, a growl that turns into derisive laughter. He would be willing to spend an eternity crushing the flies' bodies one by one between his fingers, if it'll keep them away from Wen. "I don't see any. Hey, if you can't lift her, there's just so many. Are you sure you're okay? How about you hold this thing and I'll carry—" "I'm fine. I can do this." Another voice worms into the cracks between the buzzing and Andrew and Eric's conversation. Leonard says, "Eric, turn on the TV." He says it twice. He says it like it's nothing more than a, "Hey, try this," friendly suggestion. The television. It's there on the wall in front of him. The black screen is not quite a mirror, but it reflects his face and the cabin behind him, filtering the images in dark, muted tones. There's color in the reflection, but at the same time, there's not. The rope around Leonard is white, Andrew's long hair is black, and the pooled blood is a black-red, so opaque the floor appears to be full of holes. "Eric, turn on the TV." Leonard's patient request sounds like his own thought verbalized. Yes, he could turn the TV on. It would take very little effort and would not prevent them from leaving. He could turn it on and see whatever it is they might see. Maybe it would be an answer. Maybe it would be nothing. He remembers yesterday's tsunamis and the filmed drownings and devastation. He can't remember what promised calamity is supposed to be next. What could he see that's worse than what he's already seen in the cabin? He remembers his shame and guilt while watching the rising ocean, swallowing the Oregonian coastline and its denizens, and fleetingly believing the four strangers were who they said they were. Does he believe them now? Does he believe it enough to turn on the television? What if the screen stays blank and dark? Would that mean it's all over? That everything and everyone is gone? Would he be relieved? What if the screen flashes on and bathes the cabin in light? What if the void isn't darkness, but is instead a sea of burning, unrelenting, unforgiving light? Andrew shouts at Leonard, only inches from his face. He tells him to shut up, and he doesn't give a fuck about the TV. Leonard says, "Just turn it on. Please, we have to know if we stopped it or if we didn't." And he says it as though there's only him and Eric in the room, using the minimum amount of volume to be heard, to be understood. Eric says, "We're leaving now." But he doesn't move to pick up when. Andrew says, "Eric, you're not listening to him, are you? Hey, are you all right? Maybe you should sit down for a minute." One fly lands on the TV screen's lower right corner and crawls in looping sideways eights. Eric says, "We're going to leave right now." Or maybe he doesn't and only thinks it. He reaches out, and the fly guides his hand to the power button on the inside edge of the almost invisible plastic frame. The button is hidden and half the size of his finger pad. He presses it. After a second or two of delay, a confusing, bracing collage of colors and images fills the screen to its borders, accompanied by the sound of an authority, a narrator, talking off screen. Eric squints and is initially unable to focus on what's happening. The scrolling text banners with blurry words and numbers, images changing from overhead shots of an airport to a hospital, with doctors wearing hazmat-esque shields and gowns, crowded sidewalks, bustling markets, and packed beyond capacity subways, many of the people wearing surgical masks over their noses and mouths, and quick cuts to iconic images of a metropolitan city Eric would normally recognize instantly. He succumbs to the withering onslaught of sight and sound and slinks away from the TV and the couch, and he bumps into Andrew. Andrew puts a hand on Eric's shoulder and turns him so they face each other. He asks, "Why do you do that?" And he gives Eric a confused look of betrayal. Eric doesn't recall deciding or deliberating whether to turn the television on or not. He says, "There was a fly." "A what?" "We're going. I'll get when," Eric says. His voice is a decayed echo. Leonard cries out, "We didn't stop it. We didn't stop anything. We're another step closer to the end. Andrew says, shut up. But there isn't much oomph behind it. His head is turned slightly to the television, giving it the same distrustful side glance he gave Eric. Leonard sniffles and coughs and shouts between deep, shuddering breaths. Remember, I told you yesterday, oceans would rise and drown cities, which happened. You can't deny that. You saw it. And I said then a plague would descend. Eric interrupts and says, Then you said the skies will fall and crash to earth like pieces of glass, and then a final everlasting darkness. He didn't plan on reciting that doomed litany, just like he did not plan to turn on the television. Leonard appears nonplussed at having his words repeated back to him.
Yeah.
Right, yes, I said that. Yeah, a plague would descend, and it's here, it's happening. On the screen is a slideshow of images from Hong Kong. Among them, the Blue House in Wan Chai. Andrew's favorite building from their trip. It features a museum on the ground floor called the Hong Kong House of Stories, which was where they spent their last morning in the city before heading north to Hubei Province. Back home, hanging on the wall above their computer desk are two framed photos. One with the two of them standing in front of the Blue House, their chests puffed out in Superman poses, their smiles equally heroic. The other is of the Jardine House, a beanstalk-tall skyscraper with windows shaped like giant portals or holes. This is Eric's favorite building, and Andrew playfully teases him that he only likes it because it's full of bankers. The collage of This is the City images ends, with a field reporter in the middle of the bustling Kowloon City wet market, her surgical mask pulled away from her mouth so it hangs limply around her neck. In the lower left corner of the screen, stacked above the omnipresent news scroll, is a red rectangular box. The text inside the box is the name of the program, City Zero, Hong Kong and the Fight Against Bird Flu. The reporter talks about the surging number of human cases of H7N9 in Hong Kong since January, with a mortality rate at almost 40%. The government has ordered millions of chickens and ducks culled throughout the region in recent months. And within Hong Kong, there is the growing probability of quarantines for the hardest-hit neighborhoods, and would include the closing of open-air markets. In recent weeks, dead birds with the avian flu strain have turned up in Suffolk, England, Germany, and at a Grayson chicken farm in Tennessee, increasing fears of a possible pandemic.
Why did you turn it on? Andrew asks again.
Eric shakes his head, even though it's not a yes or no question. He wipes his eyes with the backs of his sweaty, bloody hands. He repeats his,
away from this place,
prayer in his head. Andrew leans in and whispers,
Are you starting to believe him, Eric?
Eric wants to say no. He yearns to. But he is in so much pain and grief, and he is confused and fatigued, and he wants to lie on the couch next to Wen and close his eyes. And he's afraid if he says no to Andrew's question, they'll never be allowed to go away from this place. He says,
I'm sorry.
Andrew stutters through saying, Eric, what are you saying? You can't, you're not thinking clearly. Leonard says,
Guys, look, you didn't choose to make a sacrifice. Wen's death was an accident, so that won't stop the apocalypse from happening. I said a plague would come next, and here it is. Don't you see it? Everything that's happened, you have to see it now. The only way to prevent the end of everything is for you to willingly sacrifice one or the other.
Andrew dives at Leonard, throws both hands forward and hits him in the face with the wooden handle, connecting at the bridge of his nose. Leonard's head snaps back with a grunt, and blood gushes from his nose and down his already stained shirt. Eric grabs Andrew's arm and pulls him away from hitting Leonard again. He points at the TV and says,
He said there would be a plague. Andrew's voice goes high-pitched, filled with the helium of incredulity. This? I've been reading about these bird flu cases for months already. This isn't a fucking plague. It's, what, a news report? It isn't even being broadcast live. He stalks to the TV and points at the red title box on the screen. It's pre-programming. It's a TV show. It has a fucking title, for Christ's sakes. Breaking news doesn't have a title. Leonard, Sabrina, all of them knew this bird flu show was going to be on and knew what time. Leonard says, come on, Andrew, how can you shut your fucking mouth or I'll bash it in? Andrew swivels his head, looking around the room. Where's the remote? Find it and hit the guide button. You'll see the title show up in the menu. It's a fucking pre-programmed show. They knew about it before they came out here and made it part of their narrative. Eric has both arms around one of Andrew's. What Andrew is saying is rational, but it sounds desperately rational. Andrew says, so God drops a couple of earthquakes, but then had to wait for us to eat dinner and get a good night's sleep before dialing up the slow-moving, already been in the news all summer plague? Eric, they were all checking their watches this morning, all of them were, just like Leonard was yesterday. Do you remember them doing that? It was so obvious. They weren't even trying to hide it. Leonard says, I check my watch when I get nervous. He sounds sheepish, like he's apologizing. I don't even realize I'm doing it most of the time. Eric says, the others were checking their watches too. He doesn't remember them doing so, but assumes that Andrew isn't lying or misremembering. Eric says this because he wants to still be on Andrew's side. Leonard says, I'm sure they were nervous too, and the thing is, we all felt it, felt the time coming, you know? And we were made to know that your choice had to come soon. So, like anybody would, we checked our watches. Eric is beginning to believe Leonard, yet even to his ears, that explanation is awkward and clunky. Andrew says, who even wears a watch anymore? You all just check your phones, especially people your age. You're telling us you four all show up and just happen to be wearing watches? No. You knew you were coming out to this cabin and there'd be no cell reception, and you had to be able to tell time. That's not it at all, I swear. Listen to him, Eric. Can't you tell he's lying? They knew this bird flu show was on today, at this time. Just like they knew the Alaskan earthquake and the tsunami warnings had already happened before they showed up to the cabin. I know. You're right. The buzzing is all around, Eric. He thinks he knows what Leonard meant when he said he felt the time coming, like it was a physical thing made of presence and purpose. He remembers the figure made of light, and maybe what he saw was time made manifest. And that's not right, but it feels closer to the truth, and he wants to tell Andrew about it. Instead, he says, but there was another quake after the Alaskan one. That was the one that killed all those people. Leonard and the others didn't hear about that one before they showed up. That one happened live, while we watched. Eric silently prays that he's wrong, and that they will be allowed to leave. And? That was the one they predicted, and Adrian said she saw it happening at the beach with the giant rock. She didn't see anything but the Goonies. That quake was triggered by the first one, the one they knew about, and they got lucky. Why are we even talking about this, Eric? Now this bird flu outbreak, and in Hong Kong, our special place, our city, Andrew. Remember when we were there? And we called it our city. The trip to China was Eric's first time out of North America. Eric was so anxious and excited on the plane he couldn't sleep and watched 5 in-flight movies in a row. During the 4 days spent in Hong Kong, they crammed in as much as they could see and do. A rapturous final fling of their old lives before the adventure of their new one with Wen began. It means something that it's there, that it's happening there.
It doesn't mean anything. I already told you. China has been dealing with this outbreak for months. I'm not going to argue about this with you. It's what he wants. So let's go, you and me and when.
His voice breaks, and his indignation and anger evaporate. His eyes tear up.
If you're ready, then let's go. I can't. We can't stay here.
Sabrina's voice billows into the cabin from below.
Hey, it's me, Sabrina. I'm coming up the basement stairs now, okay? I'm not going to hurt anyone, so please don't hurt me.
No one answers her. Her footfalls echo on the wooden stairs, a slow, uneven dirge that changes in pitch and tone the closer she gets to the main cabin floor. She has her curled shovel blade tipped weapon with her, but she does not hold it threateningly. She carries it more like a scarlet letter, a final judgment she cannot escape. She says,
I've been down there for a while, listening to you and the TV, so I know we didn't stop it.
She looks at Andrew and Eric and sidesteps away from the basement stairs. Her face is streaked with dirt, her hair dark with sweat. Her off-white shirt is a crusted map of yesterday's blood.
I don't know how it happened, but I'm truly sorry about when. I don't know what to say.
Andrew says, then fucking don't say anything, and don't come near us.
Yeah, okay.
Sabrina leans against the wall separating the bedroom doors and cranes her head toward the screen slider.
I'm sorry about Adrian, too.
But she shouldn't have been threatening you. That wasn't supposed to happen. Turn out your pockets, Andrew says to Sabrina, and motions at her with the sledgehammer.
Why?
Keys. Keys to your car that has to be parked somewhere near here. Sabrina pulls out her empty pockets. The white cloth sticks out from her hips like mocking tongues. She rotates and runs hands over her smooth back pockets. The news report rattles on in the background, with a narrated video of dead birds bulldozed into piles and incinerated. Andrew says,
Eric, can you shut that off, please?
Eric goes to the TV, and with the vivid, flashing images close to his throbbing head, he squints and looks away. He fumbles about the side control panel, pressing buttons, until he hears the commentator cut out while discussing the most recent administration's ill-advised and crippling funding cuts to the Centers for Disease Control's pandemic preparedness programs. Eric only mutes the audio, however, and the video continues to broadcast. A spinning bout of vertigo strikes, and Eric sinks into the couch, sitting next to Wen and with the flies. Eric knows they are eager to crawl on him, too. He lifts Wen's body and slides her across his lap. She is rolled up like an ancient map to a lost place.
Andrew says, Eric, are you okay? We should go now, don't you think?
I can't. Not yet.
Are you sure? I think we really should go.
Eric says,
I don't feel right. I need a few minutes, just a few minutes. Then we'll go. Together, I promise.
He prays he will be able to keep that promise. The flies leave Wen's body and disperse like released spores. Eric is relieved they are leaving Wen, but their forming an indoor storm cloud is an awful sight. They swirl, and they land, and they creep over the walls, tables, chairs, and they crawl on Sabrina and Leonard, on their hands and their mouths, and over their eyes. Their unremitting buzzing sounds like it's crackling through the muted television speakers, and theirs is an ancient message of immutable decay, rot, and of ultimate defeat. Sabrina and Leonard. I don't feel right. I need a few minutes, just a few minutes, then we'll go. Together, I promise.
That's okay. Take some time. But we have to go as soon as you can. We can't stay here.
Andrew puts a hand on Eric's shoulder and rubs his back. Eric mumbles something they cannot hear, and he leans into Andrew's hip.
Leonard is battered, a diminished and broken King Kong after the swan dive off the Empire State Building.
Sabrina is pressed against the wall, as though standing on the crumbling ledge of a cliff face. They share a look. They wonder what the other is thinking, what the other believes, and what the other is going to do. They wonder if they've truly shared the same visions, the same commands. They wonder if the other is who they say they are. They wonder if the other is what they would consider to be a good person before they were called here. They share a protracted, probing look. They realize they do not know each other, not in the slightest. They realize in this darkest hour of the darkest day, they are alone, fundamentally alone.
Sabrina says, "This should be over, Leonard."
"But it isn't."
"I know, I know. But what happened should be enough. Why isn't it enough?"
"She wasn't a willing..."
"I don't care. It's not right. They've already lost too much. It's so not right. I can't even say how not right it is."
"I agree. But it's not up to us."
Andrew half-heartedly tells him to be quiet. Sabrina says, "I don't care what you do, but I'm going to fight it. I fought it before, I did, I swear I did. But now? No more of this, I'm done. We should have, I don't know, done something more to resist this, to reject it. There's no way."
"There will come a point when you won't be able to. You know that."
He isn't mocking or threatening. He's being commiserative.
"Why us?
Why are we being made to do this, Leonard? Why is this even happening at all? This is barbaric and vile and evil shit, and we're a part of it, all of it."
"I don't know, Sabrina. I really don't. I don't understand, and we're not supposed to understand."
"That's such bullshit.
We're trying to save billions of lives, the suffering of a few, for
it's still not right. It's all capricious and cruel. What kind of god or universe or whatever wants this demands this?"
Leonard sighs and doesn't answer.
He stares at Sabrina and blinks.
"No. No, you have to answer.
I know what my answer is. I need to know yours. I want to hear what, Leonard?"
She pauses and laughs.
"I was going to say your last name. But I don't know what it is. Isn't that fucked?"
He says, "It's..."
"I don't care about your last name. I want your answer. Tell me. What kind of god is making all this happen?"
"The one we have."
They share another look. Leonard is misshapen, grotesque, an unfinished monster. Sabrina stands at the disintegrating edge of a lava flow, and the air she breathes is poisonous. They wonder if one or both or neither of them is crazy, and they wonder if it even matters. They wonder if the other has always been as weak as they are now.
They share another long look.
This one is reserved for ill-fated observers in the moments before impending, inescapable calamity, whether it be natural disaster or the violent failure of humanity. A look of resigned melancholy and awe, unblinking in the face of a revealed, horrific, sacred truth. And they realize, again, in this darkest hour of the darkest day, they remain alone. Fundamentally, alone. Sabrina nods, and she drops her staff and it lies on the floor like a borderline.
"I never believed in it. But this is fucking hell."
Andrew.
It's clear Eric's concussion has left him more compromised than Andrew originally thought. He can't possibly give Eric the rest needed to recover enough for him to be able to walk any sort of distance, even if it's only to the other's car, parked presumably somewhere nearby. Does he leave Eric here and go for help on his own? No, that is not an option. He will never leave Eric or Wen alone again.
Andrew looks at Wen's sheet-covered body, and he can still feel Leonard squeezing his hands, his finger folding in, collapsing on the trigger, and the hitch, and the click, and the gun kicking back. He didn't know where the bullet went, and then Eric screamed and scrambled on all fours to Wen. She was lying on her back with her knees and legs bent under her. Andrew saw her shattered face, and he dropped to the floor next to Eric. His eyes flooded with tears he did not wipe or blink away, so his view would remain distorted, refracted, as though looking up from the bottom of a well. A blur of seconds later, Eric was passed out against the door, and Andrew stood alone in front of a tied-up Leonard, his gun empty of bullets, but his finger pulling the trigger. Eventually, he stuffed the gun in his back pocket, and then checked Leonard's empty ones for keys. He checked Adrian's pockets, too. He dragged her body to the deck because he didn't know what else to do. He was going to check O'Bannon's pockets, but he didn't want to leave Eric alone inside the cabin while he was unconscious, and he didn't want to leave Wen lying on the floor. He went into their bedroom and gathered the flannel sheets. As he carefully wrapped her body, everything was under water again, and he said her name. He lifted her off the floor and sat with her on the couch, and he said her name. He didn't know what else he could possibly say. He rested his forehead against hers, gently kissed the tip of her nose through the sheet, and he whispered he was sorry. He wanted to tell her the gun going off was an accident, wasn't his fault. But he couldn't. Instead, he said her name again and again. He said her name like he was afraid she would never hear anyone say it again. He said her name like it was a solemn oath to take her away from this place and bring her home. Sabrina drops her staff. The twisted shovel blade clangs at contact with the floor, knocking Andrew out of his paralyzing fugue. She says, "I never believed in it, but this is fucking hell." Leonard says, "There's still a chance. They still have a choice. They can choose to save everyone." Sabrina says, "Everyone else, you mean?" Andrew imagines hitting Leonard with a sledgehammer until his head is the lumpy, spent wax of a used candle. The gaping pit of grief and rage demands to be filled with this act. Sabrina is now unarmed, and if she attempts to intervene on Leonard's behalf, he can chop her down too. Leonard says, "Sabrina."
"What? Will you put the white mask on me? After? I don't think I'm getting out of this chair alive."
Andrew imagines bludgeoning both Leonard and Sabrina, and then sitting on the couch with Eric and Wen. He and Eric will cradle her on their laps, and they will wait in peace for as long as Eric needs, until he is ready to go. Sabrina ignores Leonard's question, slowly walks across the room and stops in front of Andrew. She says, "You never asked why we killed Redmond." Andrew takes his hand off Eric's back and regrips the weapon. Eric says,
"Don't, Andrew."
Andrew says to Sabrina,
"You mean your pal O'Bannon? That the guy you mean?"
"He was never my pal. I never trusted him, but I still came here with him, I know. I'll never be able to explain it, or even believe it myself."
Andrew says, "I'm pretty sure I can."
Sabrina nods. "We didn't come out and tell you about what our part in this is. I mean,
Besides presenting you with the choice, have you figured that out yet?
Back away now, or I start swinging, and find yourself a chair to sit in too.
Andrew has taught apocalyptic literature for years, calling his course, This is How the World Ends. The course has occasionally included a literary analysis of the Bible's Book of Revelation, and the four horsemen of the apocalypse riding their red, black, white, and pale horses. Over the years, the course syllabus has evolved, but one of the main arguments, discussions he has with his students, remains a constant. No matter how bleak or dire end-of-the-world scenarios appeal to us, because we take meaning from the end. Aside from the obvious and well-discussed idea that our narcissism is served when imagining we, out of all the billions who perish, might survive, Andrew has argued there's also undeniable allure to witnessing the beginning of the end and perishing along with everyone and everything else. He has impishly said to a classroom, to the scowl of more than a few students, Within the kernel of end times awe and ecstasy is the seed of all organized religions.
Of course, Andrew has figured out the four strangers' quasi-Christian endgame, but he doesn't want Sabrina explaining it and making biblical connections in front of Eric. His Catholic faith is as confounding and mysterious to Andrew as it is endearing, while he's in this addled, vulnerable mental state.
Sabrina doesn't move. I will sit and do whatever you ask. Just let me explain. Let me tell you this first.
Back the fuck up. Now.
Eric interjects.
If Andrew and I didn't choose to make a sacrifice, then you four had to make one. Don't talk like that.
Andrew crouches so he can look Eric in the eye. His right knee gives out on the way down. The looseness, the detachment of his swollen knee from the rest of his leg, makes his head go dizzy and hot. He wonders if he'll be able to complete any sort of hike on this knee. What if they can't get car keys from Sabrina or Leonard? Do he and Eric risk walking down the road, finding their car, and hoping they hit a key somewhere? Andrew's dad used to hide a spare to his truck in the driver's side wheel well. Maybe they go up the road in the opposite direction, deeper into the woods, and to the closest cabin that's a few miles away. Break in and hope the cabin has a phone. Everything in Andrew screams to get out of this place of death and madness and figure it all out after. He leans on the staff and says, Eric, until Eric looks at him. Listen to me. I love you. And we have to go now. All right? I know you can do it.
I love you too, but I don't. We can take breaks and rests when we're on the road, as many as we need. We'll make it.
Andrew stands, slides an arm under Eric's and tugs him up. Eric doesn't stand, and stays sitting with Wen.
Not yet. One more minute. Please.
Sabrina says, He's right, Andrew. When you didn't choose, we were forced to kill Redmond.
I don't want to fucking hear any of this, Andrew shouts.
Sabrina holds up four fingers. After he died, the earthquake and tsunami hit. She folds down her pinky, making the number three. Adrian dies, then the bird flu spreads. She curls another finger into her palm, two fingers held up, a mocking peace sign. There's only two of us left. If you don't choose to make a sacrifice, then Leonard and I will be the sacrifices. Each time one of us dies, she folds down another finger. Another calamity.
The skies will fall and crash to pieces like glass,
Eric says. Like he's participating in a call-and-response prayer. Sabrina continues, and the apocalypse is another step closer, and if you don't choose and the last of our four dies, her fist swallows up
the last finger.
Eric says, "The final darkness. That's what Leonard said."
"Then it'll be the end of everything. When the last of us are dead, there are no more chances for you to stop the apocalypse."
Andrew wobbles across the room towards Sabrina. "I said, stop talking."
"Before we got here, Leonard and I wanted to spell it all out for you. Tell you everything we knew as soon as we walked into the cabin. Redmond and Adrian talked us out of it. We knew we had an impossible cell, and look, we're not stupid or crazy. I wish we were crazy."
Leonard says, "You're not crazy."
"I think it's both now," she says, without explaining what she means.
"Andrew, you weren't going to believe us, believe why we were here, believe in the choice and the consequences, especially when we first presented it to you, and maybe not ever. So we couldn't risk telling you we would kill each other off, one by one, if you chose to never make a sacrifice. We were afraid you'd wait us out, watch us kill each other, and then the world would end."
"Get a chair, put it against the front wall, and sit down," Andrew says.
"Maybe the world should end, if any small part of it was made to be like this."
Sabrina nods, as though she's made a decision, or a pact. She faces Leonard and points at the television.
"Did you know this bird flu show was going to be on?"
Leonard is surprised by her sudden pivot.
"Huh? Yeah. Well, no, I mean, I didn't know there would be a show like this, or what kind of, plague there'd be, or even where. But I knew there'd be some kind of deadly illness."
"How'd you know?"
"Sabrina, why are you?
Before we came up here, you told us the plague would happen around 9 o'clock if they didn't make a choice in the early morning of the second day. Adrian and I had a vague sense of a plague-like calamity happening after the tsunami, but not the precise time. You gave us a time."
"I don't know what to tell you. I just knew the time it would happen, like it was always there in my head, waiting for me to find it."
"You didn't check the television programming schedule before we met up with you?"
"No, of course not."
Andrew doesn't know what Sabrina is doing, why she's now grilling Leonard about the show and the timing, why she is seemingly flipped to arguing Andrew's side. She says,
"Redmond said he knew the time too. Did he tell you first?"
"No. I knew the time before he and I, or any of us, talked about it."
"Are you sure?"
Leonard sighs.
"Yes, I'm sure."
"So he only knew the time because you told him?"
"I have no idea what he knew or was shown. Why all these questions now? You can't doubt what's happening."
Andrew says, "I really don't care anymore. You guys will have plenty of time to figure it out once we're out of here. Take that chair and sit, Sabrina, or I'm going to have to hurt you both. Know that I won't hesitate to hurt you."
Sabrina says, "I'm going to help you and Eric leave here, if you'll let me."
Sabrina, "I tell you, Andrew and Eric, the four of us hid the keys to Redmond's truck. Buried them a few paces away from the dirt road. Or maybe I should say O'Bannon instead of Redmond, because even if Andrew is mistaken, I believe that's who he is now. Redmond was awful, even when I first encountered him on the online message board. He made jokes about posting dick pics and asked what Adrian and I were wearing while we shared the dreams, nightmares, messages, and visions we were all experiencing, and what it was doing to our lives. Despite Redmond, I was relieved there were others living through the same thing. Yes, obviously our shared visions were terrifying, but as frightened as I was, finding the others meant I wasn't alone. And it meant I wasn't having some sort of psychotic break, and I could stop the obsessive self-analysis and self-diagnosis. The first night on the message board together,
We didn't know yet what the visions meant, or that we had any part to play. I hoped we were going to be like prophets or something. Warn people, you know? Warn them about what might happen if we didn't stop doing all the shitty things we're all doing to one another and to the environment. I told the others how it started with me, hearing whispers a few nights before while I was in line at In-N-Out Burger. The burger was my reward for a long day of entrance exam prep. I was planning to apply to nurse practitioner master's programs in the California State University system. So at first, I thought some creep behind me was whispering in my ear. And it wasn't just hearing the whisper. I felt breathed out air pushing through my hair and brushing the rim of my ear. I turned, but there was no one in line behind me. I must have looked like a lunatic spinning around like I did. I tried to pass it off as my own yammering brain, unable to come down from study mode, and I pawed at my ears like there was a fly or mosquito dive-bombing me. I nearly shouted my order at the confused kid behind the counter. The whispering continued, and I thought maybe it was the clunky air conditioning operating at some weird frequency. So instead of eating at the restaurant like I'd planned, I scooped everything off the tray and ran out to my car. I was exhausted and now totally freaked out, and the voice was still there with me. It wasn't in my head. It sounded like someone talking through the tiny speakers of a cell phone, but when the phone wasn't against my ear and was instead crammed inside my jeans pocket, or lost inside my bag, or it had fallen down underneath the driver's seat. Believe me, I've thought long and hard about this, and I know it's what a crazy person who doesn't know she's going crazy would say, but it wasn't in my head. That small voice existed independent of me, and it was coming from somewhere inside the car. I drove home with the radio tuned to K-Rock and blasting at full volume. I shouted, and I sang along with songs I didn't know the words to. I parked and ran up to my little second-floor studio apartment, fumbling with the keys at the front door like some slasher movie victim moments before the knife blade flashes. And then I was inside, and I dropped my food on the kitchen table, which was covered in papers and the exam practice booklet. The apartment was quiet, but for the ticking of the central air and muffled steps coming from the floor above. No voice or whispers, but my apartment seemed off, like it had been staged to look like the way I would have left it. But there were imperceptible inauthenticities. Something was wrong, or would be wrong, and all I could do was wait for the wrong to happen. The more I listened, percolating up from below those everyday background noises I usually ignored, there was a high-pitched ringing, the kind you get in your ears after a really loud concert. But it wasn't coming from inside my head or my ears. A spanned distance was communicated in how it sounded. A great, impossible distance. The ringing pitched lower, like the hum of slowing fan blades, and focused into words that were in my own voice, but not a voice I've ever used. I sat, and I listened. I never ate that stupid burger, and I fell asleep at the table, and I dreamed. Those dreams from that first night are a deck of used playing cards, the colors faded, corners bent and peeling, and some of the cards are missing, and I don't know which ones are gone, but they are the important ones, the most important. I do remember everything the voice said to me, though. And I remember the physical part of listening. I remember what those words felt like. I tell you, Andrew and Eric, the morning after finding the message board, I'd stayed up into the early morning hours typing, reading, and rereading everyone's posts. I woke up with a compulsion to drive to Valencia, a town 20 miles north of Los Angeles. I hadn't been there since I was a kid, and I had no idea why I was supposed to go or what I would find. I was still buzzing after connecting with the others online, so I indulged this compulsion instead of denying it. This might sound strange, but the idea of dropping everything to drive to who knows where was both terrifying and thrilling. And it was a relief, too. It was a relief to give in, even knowing this act of belief would irreparably change my life. I didn't want or crave that change, at least not consciously. Until the night at In-N-Out, I was 100% focused on my job and getting into a master's program, to the detriment of my already meager social life. But that didn't really matter to me. I was happy. Or, if I wasn't happy, I was all right. And that was plenty good enough. But that morning, I called in sick to the hospital, although I knew the written recommendation I needed from my supervisor for my school applications was becoming less glowing with each passing sick day, now the third in a week. She was royally pissed. But I had no choice. Or I convinced myself I had no choice either way, for this once proud and lifelong agnostic, the possibilities and implications of the fucked up adventure were intoxicating. For some reason, I'd been chosen. I was being given proof there was something out there greater than me, or greater than us, something beyond our everyday. And it was communicating with me and telling me what to do. Do you have any idea how delicious it is to give yourself over to something else so completely? So I did. I say to you, Andrew and Eric, trust the process, right? Dad's favorite saying, applied to everything from sports to career to politics to relationships to dealing with grief after Mom died a few years ago. God, I hated that saying, and how often he'd say it. It made this big, strong guy seem so mealy-mouthed, passive, weak, resigned to failure. Trust the process and a shrug. Might as well wear a shirt that reads, "Fine, I give up." I yelled at him in front of the oncologist after hearing the details of proposed and, I knew, desperate treatment. He said, "Trust the process." Like it was a goddamned hallelujah. I should tell him I'm sorry now, because I can't count how many times I've said, "Trust the process," to myself over the last 7 days. My holy mantra. I said it when I was home, and ignoring the pleading, "Where are you?" texts and voice messages from work, friends, and Dad, too. I said it when I took mesh from orthopedics and made our 4 white masks as a vision instructed me to. No reason yet to be given for their existence and usage. Never a reason. I said it when I bought the plane ticket. I said it when I met Leonard, Adrian, and Redmond for the first time at a Burger King rest stop on the highway. And I said it when I saw they were all wearing jeans and button-down shirts like me. And Redmond joked that we looked like a lame indie rock band. And I said it when the shirt's different colors made sense and told me all I needed to know about who each of us was or was supposed to be. I said it when we first verbalized what it was we were actually going to do out here at the cabin. And I said it when I looked into Redmond's pickup truck bed and saw he made the staffs for us with their spiked metal tops and the one with the bonus hammer block tacked on. Each of them right out of a dream I had on the plane ride out here. Like he'd plucked them out of my head and dropped them in the truck. And I said it when he told us about how he'd made them without remembering or knowing exactly how he'd made them. And I said it when I climbed into Redmond's truck cab. And I said it as those awful things rattled around the truck bed with each bump and turn. And I said it when we parked on a dirt road. And I said it when I picked up the weapon built for me to use. And I said it when we knew we could use the rope, but not the rolls of duct tape. And I said it when I tried to text Dad, "Trust the process. I love you." And then we left our phones in the truck, and we started walking here. And I said it before we forced our way into the cabin, and I keep saying it. I even fucking said it before I walked up the basement stairs like 10 minutes ago. Trust the process.
dumbly believe things are how they're supposed to be, and that they will work out simply because of that belief, even if you know better. I tell you, Andrew and Eric, about my impromptu trip to Valencia, how I drove north on the I-5 without any maps or GPS, and I got off at a random exit. I didn't know what I was looking for, and I navigated through suburban sprawl, and then to San Francisco Canyon Road, which goes rural in an eye blink, and carves through rolling hills and forest like a winding river. At a severe bend in the road, I pulled over and parked in a small gravel lot, buffeted by a cement divider. Beyond the divider was the former San Francisco Road. It had been closed and rerouted after numerous washouts. The closed road follows alongside the ruins of the St. Francis Dam, which collapsed in the middle of one night in March 1928, sending giant chunks of cement and billions of gallons of water rushing through the valley, wiping out houses and ranches, killing more than 400 people, washing bodies all the way to the Pacific Ocean. I didn't know anything about the dam until after I got home and looked it up online. While I was there, walking the path of the ruins, I walked alone, dutifully following the closed road, which was being overrun and swallowed up by the surrounding vegetation and clay and dirt. I walked through the valley, dry and bleached, and as empty of people as the surface of the moon. There was a cloudless blue sky above the craggy, shadowed faces of the surrounding hills, and the only sounds came from bugs, and it felt like I was walking through a post-apocalyptic landscape. My earlier excitement quickly faded. Whatever I was going to be shown, I was sure I wouldn't be able to stop it, and my only purpose was to be a witness. I tell you, Andrew and Eric, I now wish my only role was to be a passive witness of the end. I took my time, and I was careful not to walk too fast so I could see and mark everything, and maybe 30 minutes in, there was a 15-foot-tall, cubed-shaped boulder of a dam just off the road, and squatting in the brush like a sunning tortoise. Its sand-colored, crumbly concrete was striated, and from the road it looked like a section of a staircase for a giant. Like I said, I didn't know it was a piece of the St. Francis Dam until I got home, so I didn't know what it was other than a man-made ruin. A leftover. A gravestone for a doomed past. I kept walking and following the road, and maybe another 30 minutes later I stopped. I was made to stop. I now think I was in the spot where the dam had been built and spanned across the valley. I left the road and hiked over to an area covered with rubble, a mix of stones and small bits of porous cement. I stood in the lowest point of the valley, and it was as quiet as the bottom of the sea. I expected, I don't know, to see someone or something, I still can't bring myself to say God, or a God, come over the hilltops and, this sounds crazy, I know, grab me, pick me up, because I felt doll-sized, and I didn't think I was alone anymore. And it wasn't a good feeling. Then everything went black. I tell you, Andrew and Eric, I know Adrian said she saw the Goonies rock and the tsunami before we saw it all on TV. I never saw that. I won't lie to you, that's a promise I can keep. I'd marched the path of a great flood without knowing it, and I didn't see anything other than darkness. It wasn't like I'd lost time or something, and it had become night in the valley. It wasn't night dark. I couldn't see anything. There was nothing. I was nothing. But then I heard groans and high-pitched sounds of stress, and I could only imagine one of the hills was going to burst or break above me. There was a thunderous crack and a low vibrato whoosh, sounding like the earth itself giving a defeated sigh. And then an ocean of water cascading and rushing over me, past me, and into the landscape I could no longer see. There was the percussive snapping of trees and crunch of collapsing houses and buildings. There were